Hello, welcome to Spotlight. Glittering art in the dark as the hour slips back.
Spotlight, brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
This evening, we hear about a wind workshop weekend. Try saying that six times quickly. Enjoy a sneak preview of a splendid new exhibition in Peel and drop into the launch of an exhibition of work by one of the island's best known and collected artists. Remember, do get in touch with any creative artistic endeavours you might be involved in planning, hoping to create, or would really like to put in the spotlight. Yes, I know, poetic, theatrical, musical, literary, ceramic, sculpture, drag, film, mime, social media, the list goes on and on and on, you know it. What you might not know is you can get on the programme. Just drop me a line, howardcaine@manxradio.com, spotlight@manxradio.com. Love to hear from you. Let's get you on there. The more, the merrier, as they say. So much to see, so little time. Well, happily, you have got some time when it comes to our first piece this evening on the programme, as this event hasn't even opened yet. But we managed to sneak down to see the final preparations ahead of what will be surely a very popular exhibition down there in Peel.
And we have come down to the House of Man Arts preview of a wonderful new exhibition about to start here. Just the finishing touches, it's all being put together, ready for the opening this very Friday. So we're very privileged to have a little quick peek around whilst all the work's still going on and things are all getting finished off. And we've come down to, well, I'll get her to introduce herself.
My name is Alison Fox and I'm Curator of Archaeology for Manx National Heritage.
And this is a wonderful new exhibition, even though it's not obviously complete as we're standing here now, I can tell it's going to be an absolute treat. National Treasures. Give us a little bit of the genesis of this.
Really, this was formed from a desire to share some of the incredible treasures that have been found in the past few years. We really, really punch above our weight on the Isle of Man. You know, we're small, but we're right in the middle of everything. And the archaeological treasures just keep coming up. You know, every so often I'll pop up on the radio or something about, oh yes, well, this amazing piece of Viking Age treasure has been found, you know. And we really wanted to bring people the message that we've got this amazing resource of treasure. So we wanted to sort of show them how fantastic the treasure looks, how beautiful a lot of this material is as decorative objects, but also just to explain, you know, why is it important? You know, yeah, it looks amazing. We can be very proud of ourselves, like we've got all this treasure, but, you know, what does that actually mean? What does it tell us about the Isle of Man in the past and where we are now? So that's the main thrust of the exhibition text, really. But we've got some key objects that have been recently conserved and in a way restored, and it's the first opportunity that people will have to see them in their newly cleaned and displayed state.
There's a couple here we'll just take a look at in a moment just to give you a flavour of it, but it's a joint exhibition, so obviously MNH and also there's pieces here from the British Museum.
Yeah, we're really pleased that we've been able to work with the British Museum and get a number of objects on loan from them for the duration of the exhibition, so just about 3 months. We talk a bit about it in the exhibition, but just over 100 years ago, when there wasn't a Manx Museum, important archaeological treasures were still being found, but there wasn't really anywhere over here that could keep them for the public and that the public could see them and researchers could see them. So quite often things of importance were taken across, so to the British Museum, but actually National Museums of Ireland, National Museum of Scotland as well, with there are Manx items in their collections. As far as we can work out, the earlier records of discovery are a little bit hazy, but as far as we can work out, the material that we'll have on loan for the British Museum hasn't been displayed on the island before. We have replicas of some of the artefacts on display in the Viking Gallery in the Manx Museum, but this will be the first opportunity, certainly in living memory, for people to be able to see these fantastic items on display on the Isle of Man.
And as you say, the wonderful thing now is, of course, with Manx National Heritage and the Manx Museum, the wonderful work that goes on with the pieces which, as you've been saying, they keep turning up most years when there's a dig, something else wonderful turns up. These pieces now, as I understand it, would then stay on the Isle of Man.
Yeah, the legislation changed in the 1970s, largely thanks to Marshall Cubbon, previous director of the Manx Museum, but also there were a number of other people involved then as well. It was a time where there was a bit of a constitutional crisis, I think, between the Isle of Man and the UK. So the time of Radio Caroline, when, you know, the UK was saying you can't do that broadcasting in Manx waters, and, you know, Tynwald was saying, well, we can. Anyway, there was a whole raft of new legislation that went through, and one of these was Treasure Trove, and that was the first time that we had the legal term is the preemptive right to any treasure found here. So that was Marshall Cubbon really led the charge with that. And we were also very, very fortunate to have had a sympathetic ear in the British Museum. The director of the British Museum at the time was Sir David Wilson. So, you know, it doesn't sound that long ago, the 1970s.
Oh, no.
But yeah, so since then. So we talk a little bit about the legislative side of things in the exhibition of treasure, you know, what is treasure, the legal definition. But we also talk about the finders as well, because it's, you know, my job's great. I sort of, you know, sit in the Manx Museum and people bring all these glorious things to me. You know, in the past, it was people, we've got a hoard on display that was discovered when they were doing the railway at Port St. Mary in the 1800s. But of course, nowadays, it's usually metal detectorists. But archaeologists find some treasure as well. And we've got an absolutely amazing example of that on display here as well.
There is some terrific stuff. Is there quite a lot of collaboration between the museums? Because you often go to, whether it's here or in Britain or elsewhere, you'll go to an exhibition, it will be on loan from another museum, some of the artefacts. Is that fairly common in the museum world?
It is, yeah. We tend to work very well together, and we have in the Manx Museum we have a couple of items on loan from National Museum of Scotland, National Museum of Ireland, but also the island has lent some of its own material. There was a few years ago, it was the anniversary of the sinking of the HMS Racehorse that led to the foundation of the RNLI. Some of the artefacts from HMS Racehorse that we have in the Manx National Collections went on display down at Chatham Historic Dockyard. We've had the Pagan Lady's beautiful necklace from Peel Castle was loaned to Jorvik a few years ago. And I think that's one of the things we want to sort of bring home for this exhibition as well, is that we're not the poor relation over here. You know, our archaeological treasures are absolutely of international significance.
Absolutely. And I assume a lot of work behind the scenes to pull exhibitions like this together.
Yeah, it is. Any exhibition, you know, you've got to, you sort of start with an idea, which I think is a great idea. and then 2 years later, you're four days away from opening, you know. But yeah, you start with an idea, and then you've got to try and think of, well, what do we say about that? How can we tell a story? You know, it's always my colleague and boss, Kirsty Neat, is always very keen, you know, to say, don't put a book on a wall. You know, people don't come to the exhibitions to read lots and lots of things. They can do that elsewhere. The thing that we can do that other people can't is show the original objects and, of course, have text associated with those. So all the planning of the text writing, our fantastic graphic designer, Christina, puts the sort of vision that we have as well. Conservation team, you know, Chris and Emma, our conservators, have worked so hard on this material because it's really specialised, you know, it's really precious, you know, in every sense of the word. And then, of course, our technicians who sort of, you know, have been here for the past 3 weeks and, you know, actually...
getting everything
and it's that kind of talent that MNH has that enables us to put these shows on, and you know that they always look amazing. You know, the Archibald Knox exhibition looks
stunning.
Amazing.
Stunning.
You know, that's MNH, the MNH team. You know, so yeah, that's great.
And this, I think, is going to be every bit as good. We'll just whet people's appetite with something they'll see when they come in through the door, which is AD 950, a silver brooch. Now, when we say brooch, I'm not talking about the little thing that your granny has on her hat or the side of her cardigan. This thing is huge.
It's massive. It's absolutely massive. We, when it was first declared treasure in 2020, the finder, Kath Giles, a metal detectorist, Kath and I did quite a lot of media around this. It was in its different components then. It wasn't all sort of attached together as it is now, and it wasn't fully cleaned. But at the time, we were talking about, you know, the sort of what this would mean if, at the time, 1,000 years ago, you know, this is somebody who is like proper showing off. You know, you're not going to wear that and think, I'll just blend into the background.
Not easily.
You know, but it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. There have been other brooches of this type found from the Viking Age, but this is one of the largest of its kind. It's really amazing. And the sort of the detail of the decoration is incredible. This in itself would be a find that would, you know, set you up for the rest of your life, really. But along with that, there's a highly decorated silver armband, but also a gold arm ring, which is probably about 90% pure gold.
And that's just stunning, isn't it? It looks like it could have been made yesterday.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And that most of the time, the gold material doesn't really need anything doing to it. You know, it's very robust. It kind of comes out of the ground, more or less the way it went in. But silver is different. You know, it can corrode in the ground. It can change colour as well. So people will come in, they might sort of see a little purple tinge to some of the silver jewellery, some of the silver coins perhaps as well. We haven't cleaned every coin because we wanted to give people an idea of the different patination that comes out. And one of the things we also say in the exhibition is the importance of not doing any cleaning to anything. It's really, really tempting when these things are discovered, you know, to think, oh, what does that look like? But all of the finders from the finds in this exhibition have found these things, and they've been so careful with them. They've contacted us, and so then we can start the process of cleaning and researching just to make sure that we, once they're out of the ground, we don't compromise their safety.
They are stunning pieces there, and it's fascinating. Human nature doesn't change, does it? You know, 950, going back to 915, people were very happy to, if they had their wealth, if you got it, flaunt it.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Definitely would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, nowadays, I suppose, it would be watches and cars. And
Yeah.
And then round the other side here, I know we had a quick sneak peek before, we just paddle around the other side of this case, is a truly gorgeous piece of jet, which again, it looks so modern, that piece, doesn't it? Yet it's 2000 BC.
Yeah, I think it. I've been doing this job here for quite a long time, and you know, it never ceases to amaze me the quality, let alone the quantity of material that comes up from the island, but the quality. And this jet bead necklace is again amongst the best of its type. You know, we sort of say that, as we've just said about the silver brooch, but it really, really is. It's in very good condition. However, it has taken a lot of careful, tender, loving care from our conservation team to get it to this stage and also to restring it. It was found in archaeological excavations, research excavations at Burke Farm, just near Kirkmichael on the west coast, and it was individual beads when it was found in the ground. So the position of all those beads have been mapped by the archaeologists from Newcastle University and the University of Leicester, so Dr. Chris Fowler and Dr. Rachel Krellin. And once this came out of the ground, jet is quite a fragile material, so we had to be very careful we didn't risk compromising the integrity of that material. So Chris, our conservator, took a long time in conserving this and getting it to a stage where it's stable, not only stable, but we were able to restring it. And it looks amazing. And I think we talk a little bit about ancient technology, and this is a prime example. We can see with some of the decorated plates, you can see on one there's 5 strings of beads going in and then 7 coming out. So inside there, and we've got x-rays, inside that jet bead, there's a junction. So 4,000 years ago, they had the technology.
It's the technology and the amount of skill involved in producing the piece
at
a time when you thought it was, you know, pretty basic.
I know, yeah. And that's it. You know, we sort of think about, you know, 4,000 years ago, the early Bronze Age. And it's, you know, without glasses, you know, that spectacles or artificial light, These people, you know, they're creating these incredible things, you know, that last for 4,000 years, you know, and now they're out, and we've got a duty to help protect them for the next, you know, the next 4,000 years.
So. Absolutely so. Well, that's just a little taste of what you can see when you come down to this exhibition, National Treasures, down at the House of Mananin. So it is opening this Friday.
Yes, we are having a little opening event on Friday evening with His Excellency and Lady Lorimer in attendance, and then it will be open to the public from Saturday.
Marvellous. And how long will it be on display, all these pieces?
We're just about 3 months, so we go through Christmas. So it's a lovely, sparkly treasury exhibition for Christmas, up until the end of January.
Well, that's terrific. Highly recommend it. I've just given you a little taster there. They're just finishing off, and it's going to be stunning if you can get yourself down there. 3 months, and yeah, sparkly thing to go for Christmas. But I'm afraid you can't have the jet necklace.
There really is some wonderful stuff there. The brooch is so big, it almost looks like a weapon rather than jewellery. Amazing. And that jet necklace, stunning. Many pieces, as we said, not seen before. Get yourself down there between now and Christmas and enjoy.
Spotlight. Brought to you by the Isle of Man Arts Council.
From an exhibition just about to open, to one which just has. Aileen Sher must be one of the best known and iconic artists on the island, with her instantly identifiable artworks, folkloric, dreamy, primitive, intricate, ambiguous, all the above, curious figures interacting with equally curious animals, with rooks or crows or blackbirds of some kind never far away. Her latest exhibition opened last weekend down in Port St Mary at Studio 42. I was delighted to be invited down and, amidst the wonderful paintings, wine and nibbles, managed to grab a word with Aileen herself and gallery owner Eben Carswell.
And a quick 2 minutes down at the latest Aileen Sher exhibition down in Port St Mary. A foul day, but fantastic paintings as ever. Small paintings.
Yeah.
Is that very deliberate?
My larger acrylic paintings, I'll be having a show of them in 2027.
All right, so you're working on those at the same time as these small ones?
These are the small gouaches.
So they're all gouache?
Yeah.
All of them. And do you find that, certainly from your collectors, and there are lots of Aileen collectors now, I mean, do they tend to go for the smaller works simply because they're easier to hang?
I have no idea whether they like them or not.
I think they all like them. You can tell from talking to people today.
All right. Okay. Well, I don't know.
I think you can fit them in. That your house is easier for the big statement piece.
Yeah.
So both have their place.
Yeah. And I think that is exactly it, isn't it? There's one or two of your larger pieces I'm thinking, ooh, I'd love that. But I'm thinking,
where am I going to put it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Whereas you can get a few of these in.
Oh, yeah, you can definitely get quite a few of these. What do you think? Well, you've been attached with Aileen's art for quite a few years.
Too many, yes. Yes, no, privilege.
And what do you think is the unique appeal? Because it is a sort of totally unique artwork.
I think it's a sort of universal folklore, dreamlike feel about them that does appeal to everyone.
They're quite uplifting as well and make people happy, I would imagine.
I think they do. And also, as Evan was saying, it's got that folkloric, as you say, sort of feel about it, and a quite sort of dreamy feel as well sometimes.
Yes, and quite poetic.
And is that where the inspiration, I mean, do any of these sort of come to you in your dreams, or do you have an idea of before you start?
I have an idea, but they don't turn out the way they go on a journey.
Do they start in one? You have an idea when you start it?
I have an idea and I start it, but then they become something different.
They take a life of their own,
yes,
as they say.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And then whoever buys it takes it on another journey,
yeah,
because they read in
whatever
they see into it.
Absolutely.
Well, so.
Oh, I do that. I mean, I've got several at home, and every time I look, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I wonder if that bird's doing such and such a thing and such like. What about the naming? Because there was a lady I was just talking to before saying, oh, I love looking at the titles of all of them.
Well, I like them to be quite ambiguous, the titles.
And do you do the painting first?
No.
And then
always
title?
Always at the end, yeah.
So the title comes after the painting, or the painting after the title?
The titles come after the painting.
Yeah.
Well, I quite like some of the literalness of them. There's one there called Parrot Talking, and it is literally a woman talking to the parrot. I just like the bit of a wink, tongue-in-cheekness of it. It's like, yeah, of course, just talking to a parrot. What else would I be doing?
Whereas, like, there's a couple of lovely sheep ones there, and I may or may not have gone for one of them, but I just like the fact one of the sheep ones is called Birdsong, because there's a sheep at the front.
Yeah,
birds.
I had to think twice when I was putting the red dot on it. I was like,
That's why it's ambiguous, you know, so it keeps gets your mind thinking.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, listen, it's been a great pleasure today. Great crowd, even though there's terrible weather. How long is the exhibition on for down here?
It's on for another 4 weeks till mid-November. So about November 19th.
It's mid-November.
So plenty of time. Wednesday to Saturday.
And I'm open Wednesday to Saturday in the week.
Wednesdays to Saturdays from 10 or lunchtime?
10 till 5 in the week and 10 till 4 on Saturdays.
Brilliant. Well, congratulations, Eileen. Another wonderful exhibition. A bigger exhibition, you say, well, the larger works in 2027.
Yes.
Right, but look forward to that. In the meantime, get yourself down to Port St Mary. Come and check them out. They are going like hot cakes, so you do fancy one for your wall. And you don't need too big a wall for some of these works because they're just nicely sized and beautifully framed. Then get yourself down here because they'll all be gone soon.
I just love Eileen's work. I confess, I may have weakened and added another to my burgeoning collection featuring the aforementioned sheep. It's well worth checking out if you have a hankering to add to your own collection or perhaps to buy a first piece. But don't hang around. There were quite a few red dots out before I left. From brushwork to brasswork now, or should that be silverwork, the wonderfully named Wind Workshop Weekend will wend its way towards us this very week. Can't think of any more W's, giving wind players of all standards a chance to learn or improve their techniques with other players in a workshop-style weekend and working with a top guest conductor. The joint conductor of the Isle of Man Wind Orchestra, John Kinley, told me more.
This is a weekend that the Wind Orchestra promote every year. The idea is to bring over a renowned musician from the wind band world to work with both the regular members of the orchestra and actually any other brass, wind or percussion players on the island who'd like to come along and join us for the weekend. The visiting conductor usually brings some interesting new repertoire to have a look at, and we work on technique, we work on performance, all the things that are associated with that. And there's a workshop concert right at the very end of it at about 2, well, in this particular case, it'll be at 2 o'clock on Sunday at the end of the event, just to sort of show the general public what we've done, what we've learnt over the weekend.
And it's Duncan Stubbs is the conductor. Duncan Stubbs, OBE, I've missed out his,
yeah, Wing
his
numbers there. Duncan
Wing
Stubbs.
Commander Stubbs. Quite a prestigious figure coming across.
Yes, very much so. I mean, Duncan has been over, I think, twice before and has become a very good friend of the Wind Orchestra. And, yeah, his musical pedigree is second to none. He's a former director of music of the Royal Air Force, conducted all the RAF bands over the years, was actually commissioned to write a fanfare for the marriage of the current Prince and Princess of Wales in 2011. And since he retired in 2017, he's gone on to work with other bands, school, college bands, very, very active in the wind band world, writing music, conducting, adjudicating, you name it, he's done it in the wind band world.
Who's it aimed at these weekends? I mean, does sort of anyone at any level go along?
Pretty much so. It's certainly open to anybody. We tend to sort of say you ought to be sort of grade 3 standard or above on a wind, brass or percussion instrument. And it, very much it's standard. You don't have to have the piece of paper as long as you feel you're round about that sort of standard. If anybody who's not perhaps that standard wants to come along and have a go, they'd be very welcome. But that's generally quite a good yardstick. And it can be people who've been playing 2 or 3 years who are still at school. It can be people who are, as we say, regular members of the wind orchestra, people who are ex-members of the wind orchestra who can't come at the moment for whatever reason, people who've retired, people who've never done it before, who play in the local brass bands, the symphony orchestra. Anybody's very welcome.
And who chooses the repertoire? Is that you or the visiting conductor?
The visiting conductor comes up with a list of what we might have a look at and runs it past myself and my colleague Paul Dunderdale, and we offer some ideas and some suggestions about what we think might work and what might not work, but they're very much in the driving seat about what we will do.
And we've got a mix of subs. I see Philip Spark, Peter Graham, Malcolm Arnold, well-known names this year.
Giants of the wind band world, really, and the brass band world, writing stuff. So Duncan has picked very carefully out of those. He's also bringing some of his own music that he writes. And we're going to look at some of the concert repertoire that's currently in the wind orchestra folder. So things like we have some music from Doctor Who at the moment. We have some music by Billy Joel. So a real cross-section of wind band repertoire over the weekend.
So it's taking place Friday the 24th, so there's Fridays and then Saturday and then through to the Sunday, and it's sort of through the day and the concert at the end of all this.
That's right. So the first rehearsal is Friday the 24th of October, 7 till 9. This is at St Ninian's Lower School, Bemhaig. So we rehearse, say we meet on the Friday night. Saturday, 10 till 4, there will be a break for lunch in there, and then Sunday, 10 till 1, rehearsing, and then a workshop concert at 2 o'clock, probably done by about 3 o'clock.
And is that open to anyone, or is that sort of like a closed shop, as it were?
Anyone can come along to the concert, they'd be very, very welcome. And if anybody would like to actually say, come and join us to actually play for the weekend, if they just either go onto our Facebook page and contact us via that, or they can email concertmanager@iomwo.com, and Bev, who's managing that sort of side of it all, will get in touch and get you on the list. The cost is £25 for most people, but if you're in full-time education, it's free.
And that's very reasonable, really. 25 quid to have, you know, work with such a prestigious conductor and all the rest of it. I mean, you can't go wrong, can you?
Completely. It's a bargain, Howard.
It is a bargain. You don't get many of those these days.
You don't.
And just what would you say to anyone, what would you say do you think is the benefit of these sort of annual events?
I think it's just opening your mind to new repertoire, opening your mind to new ideas, gaining transferable musical skills that you can take and learn from Duncan and apply to the other things that you do. There are always, I mean, I've been doing these sort of things a long time, and there's always a nugget of information that you go, I'd never thought of that before, I'll take that. And then lo and behold, a week, a month later, you're trotting out the same nugget of information to other people thinking, that was useful, that was really insightful. So it's every day is a school day in music. You're always learning things. You can always find things out. And this is a fantastic opportunity over a couple of days to really immerse yourself in some new ideas and lots of takeaways for your other music making.
Absolutely true. It has to be said, always learning in music. And just anyone listening to this perhaps thinks, you know what, that appeals. They've never been before. What's the best place for them to contact?
So either email our concert manager, who's Bev, and that's on concertmanager, all one word, at iomwo.com, or drop into the Isle of Man Wind Orchestra's Facebook page and contact us via that.
Sounds good, doesn't it? And what a great opportunity to work with such a prestigious figure in the music. That's about it for now. We'll be back next week when we'll be hearing about Remember Me to All at Home, a unique evening of drama and music at the Ballachamine Studio Theatre. See you then. And in the meantime, be good, and whatever you're doing, be creative about it. Hey, Moo.